auhea oko e koka aha, inahe kuliana imua okea aha, ko o kolo kolo ki e ki e hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E naoi mai, e malio mai, i lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give ye attention and ye shall be heard.
Please call the case.
Calling case number SCWC-20-714, State of Hawaii versus George Van Blindberg. Arguing for the appellant, Van Blindberg, Emmanuel Guerrero. Arguing for the appellee, State of Hawaii, Don Fudo. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning. Aloha, Mr. Guerrero. You can be seated. Again, thank you to both of our attorneys for your flexibility and transitioning to a remote proceeding this morning. The court really appreciates it. The proceeding is being broadcast live on our Judiciary YouTube channel. And during the course of the proceeding, if the justice has a question, they'll raise their hand virtually, and I will call upon them at the earliest opportunity. I'd like to ask our attorneys to introduce themselves in the order in which they'll be arguing today. Mr. Guerrero.
May it please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice and Justices. Emmanuel Guerrero, on behalf of petitioner, defendant appellant, George Van Blindberg.
Thank you, Mr. Guerrero. Mr. Fudo.
Good morning, Your Honor. Don Fudo, representing the State of Hawaii.
Thank you, Mr. Fudo. Just to confirm, Mr. Guerrero, you have 30 minutes with 10 minutes for rebuttal. So we'll give you a light when you hit 20 minutes into your argument, and then you'll hear a light and a tone at the end. Mr. Fudo, you have 30 minutes for your argument. You've asked for warning with 7 minutes to go. So you'll see a light at that point, and then again, a light and a tone when it's all over. Yes, Mr. Fudo.
I don't see Justice McKenna. It's got to be me. It's okay. Now I see Justice McKenna.
There you go.
I'm sorry.
Nope. We're all good. I think I see it. I see all of our justices. I see the two of you, and I see our lights in the courtroom. So we'll be able to keep close attention to when your time expires. So if everyone's set and we're all good, Mr. Guerrero, please proceed with your argument. Thank you.
Yes. May it please the court. Again, Emmanuel Guerrero, on behalf of petitioner, defendant, appellate, George Van Blindberg. Mr. Van Blindberg actually wanted to be here, but I think the court is aware that he is in custody serving his time. And unfortunately, at the Saguaro prison facility, they're unable to link to the YouTube due to security reasons. But with that being said, the issues in this case is, as stated in our application and the petition and the writ that's been granted by this court, and we're here before you, the issue is the ICA gravely erred when it held that a day or 2 days before the trial commenced, because the state provided the jury instruction to rectify and clarify the defective charge in count one, that it in effect, although the complaint was defective on its face, the ICA said it's okay. It cured it under the Mata Wells liberal construction. It's our position that that did not cure it in this case. The foundation of due process here in the state of Hawaii is grounded on the Constitution. It's grounded in the Constitution in the Hawaii state, as well as the United States Constitution. And within the last few days, not related to Hawaii state in terms of this particular case, but again, the highest court in the land had made it clear that if there is a specific right afforded to you as drafted by the drafters of the Constitution, it's a fundamental right. Here, we have a fundamental right that was violated. Article 1, Section 14 of our Constitution specifically provides, it provides notice must be given in the form of one, the charging document, the state must provide the elements of the offense to the accused, to the citizen, so that the citizen can properly prepare a defense to the charges that he or she is facing. Secondly, in addition to that, the state has to provide notice of the cause or the facts or the particulars of the charges supporting the allegations. So let's talk about count one first, leaving the scene in essence. The state had failed to provide notice. The providing of the information 2 days or 3 days or even a few days before the trial in the form of jury instruction does not cure that defect. The incident supporting the charges occurred in 2016. Trial commenced in 2020. It doesn't cure it.
Mr. Guerrero, we have a question from Justice Wilson. Justice yes. Wilson.
Yes, Chief Justice. Justice Wilson, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Guerrero. I wanted, since you're on the issue of count one, and I think your allegation that there was an adequate notice of the charge, presumably you are focused primarily on the omission of the language that pertains to the requirement that every stop shall be made without obstructing traffic more than is necessary, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. If you take a look at 291C14, guess
okay.
what?
That's all right. Well, I wanted to establish that so I could ask you a question.
Okay. Let me just point out, Justice Wilson. If you look at that specific element, which State versus Baker did tell us, it is an element of the offense. If you look at that, it's right there in the statute. It's clear. It's the last sentence of 291C14. There is no confusing. There's no confusion as to whether or not it's incorporated somewhere. It is right there. It shall. So there's no mistaking that fact. And
well, I'm going to assume for this question that your position is, I think you've just stated it, that this is an element of the offense, right? It's an attendant circumstance of the offense. And from that point of view, I wanted to ask you, is it your view that there is no way to cure the failure to include this element of the defense? And in that sense, does it make a difference whether we have the Wells Mata liberal construction rule or not?
Well, of course, I think if you look at the Mata case, the court said that, and they put it in a footnote. I believe it's the Mata case where they put it in the footnote where it says, it's going to take maybe 15 minutes, maybe an hour more. I'm not quite sure if it was the Mata case, but I do believe that was it. And the cure to a defective charge is to refile the charge.
Okay, so your position is there wasn't a way to cure this, which I think also you're taking the position that this court and the intermediate court were not free to look beyond the defective indictment and consider whether notice was given, correct? Because it appears that in Shaw and Baker, where there was a determination made that there was an element lacking, that the court did not look beyond the defective indictment to determine whether adequate notice was provided. So is that your position, that the court should not consider, for example, the jury instruction that was submitted in this case?
Well, I think you have to take a look at the charge itself. When you look at Baker, there was actually a trial. just like how we have in in this case, there was a trial. There was discovery provided. And the court looked at the charging document. In Shaw, there were two counts. Well, the first count was defective for failing to include an essential element, but there was a corresponding count, a count three, that supported count one. So that was okay. But I think we start from the beginning. Because
In Shaw, there was a determination that the failure to include continuing course of conduct was a failure to include a attendant circumstance, and therefore that charge was defective.
Okay, I stand corrected. But the premise is the same, is that notice must be provided from its inception so that at the inception of the case, the defense has an opportunity to start formulating its case, because we have to take the premise. We cannot forget the premise that the burden is on the government to prove its case beyond a reasonable doubt, that the defense, by constitutional right, they don't have to prove their innocence. They don't have to prove anything. They have a Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. They have a Fifth Amendment right about not to testify. And by failing to provide the elements of the charge in this case, essentially, the defendant is led into a situation where the avenue or the course of action he or she takes might be different. Because if you take a look at the evidence in this case, the element of leaving the last portion of as close thereto without obstructing traffic. Yes, that was in the instructions. But guess what? The government didn't argue that at its closing argument. Defense did not argue that at its closing argument. And it's an element of the offense. So that's the reason why notice must be provided to all of the elements of the offense, so that the defendant, the accused, the citizen, has an opportunity to put up a defense as to what the charges are. As a matter of fact, Rule 7, I think it was Justice McKenna who pointed it out in Baker, that Rule 7 of the Rules of Penal Procedure requires a factual basis for the allegations. And in the latest case of State versus Jardine, in a similar type of case where the charge is defective, Justice Nakayama included the phrase, if the charge is generic, it's defective. Secondly, the state should include a particulars of the offense that would support the charge. So that's what we have here. We don't even go to the second part, because the government has failed at its inception to include that last particular element of.
Mr. Guerrero, we have questions from Justice Edens and Justice McKenna. So I'll turn to them at this point.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Guerrero, you know, Baker held that when a defendant stops in close proximity of the accident scene and provides all the 291C14 requisite information, then the state must prove that the defendant's failure to stop as close as possible to the scene was not due to the defendant avoiding an unnecessary obstruction of traffic. Now, given that the state alleges that Van Blijenburg did not stop in close proximity to the accident at all, do you think that this last component, avoiding unnecessary obstruction of traffic, is really an element of the crime charged here in this case?
Yes, it is. Justice Eddings, yes, it is. And the reason for that is this. In Baker, it was it was clear that Baker actually stopped, had a brief conversation, and they had discussion as to where they were going to meet. In this case, Mr. Van Blyenburg is charged in count one with causing, being involved in an accident where it caused the death of another or serious bodily injury. The facts in this case shows that as Mr. Van Blyenburg was going up the road at Aya Heights, he, for whatever reason, he passed out. At least that's what the evidence seems to suggest. He passed out. He believed he hit something. And when he did that, although he did not come to a complete stop, he slowed down. He took a quick look from within his vehicle.
Mr. Gurra, let me ask you this then. I mean, that's the facts, but or at least according to his viewpoint. But do you think then, if it is an essential element, that the state needed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that your client's decision to park at his friend's house was not necessary to avoid obstructing traffic? In other words, should the state have introduced evidence that there wasn't a parade, there wasn't a construction project going on, for example, to prove that Van Blyenburg could have stopped closer to the scene than his friend's house without obstructed traffic? Are you saying that that's something the state had to prove in this case?
Yes, it's the burden of proof is on the government on all of the elements of the offense. And they have to prove that even assuming he stopped, was the stop, did the stop obstruct traffic or not? Yes, it's the government's burden to prove, but we do have evidence that when Mr. Van Blyenburg did in fact realize he heard something, he slowed down and he looked, but he also testified. And I think, again, the burden of proof is on the government, but he did testify that that's a one road, winding road, going up the hill slightly, and that he has to take a wide turn. So yes, it is the government's burden to prove that he did not obstruct traffic and that the location that he finally stopped at was a place that did not in fact obstruct traffic. So yes, it is the government's burden to prove that element of the offense, Your Honor.
Mr. Guerrero, Justice McKenna has a question.
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Guerrero, do you concede that the liberal construction standard does not apply in this case?
Well, you know, Marta tells us that they can take a look at if the motion to dismiss based on defective charge is made after trial or during trial, then it indicates that you can take a look at other things. But it's our position in this particular case itself as to count one, it should not apply to Van Blyenburg's case. Because to say that the information was provided during trial.
No, let's just, all right. My question is, does the liberal construction standard apply to this case where the motion is based, filed post-conviction but pre-appeal?
Well, I believe the standard is, well, Mwada tells us that it's after trial or not pre-trial. But what I am saying in this case is in the Mwada case, that information was provided early on. As a matter of fact, all of the cases cited were provided early on. In this case, it was provided the day that the jury instructions were submitted. And
after all of the evidence has concluded, and one of the purposes of this, of the charging requirement being to provide the defendant with notice of what he or she or what the defendant must defend against. Correct?
Yes, but then by giving such late, if that's the rule, you essentially what essentially happened is, It places the defendant on a position where he either has to testify or not to testify, because all of a sudden he's being told, hey, This is another element of this is another element of the offense. So he was not given that notice previously. So he had to make a choice at that point. Do I follow my Fifth Amendment right? Or do I challenge the government's burden of proof? And now I testify and prove my innocence as opposed to having the government prove its case. If the charge was done properly to begin with, we would not be in this situation.
Okay, so I have a much more like esoteric question that does not specifically apply to your client's case, but our case law does seem to be a little bit unclear as to when the liberal construction standard should apply, whether it's post-trial or whether it's when jeopardy attaches, or if it's after conviction, or whether it only applies if the issue is raised on appeal. And one of the purposes of this charging requirement appears to be to provide notice. But we have said in our case law that the purpose of the charging requirements and all of the notice requirements are due process, as well as, you know, the article that you said that says you have to provide notice. But we have also talked about double jeopardy. But it seems that Wells did not apply the liberal construction standard applied the liberal construction standard even after jeopardy had attached. So I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on when you think the liberal construction standard should apply. Is it when jeopardy attaches? Is it after conviction? Or is it only if the issue is raised on appeal?
I think it should apply on appeal. And I'll tell you why. If it applies after jeopardy attaches, there's going to be the question that the defendant was playing both sides of the field, waiting till jeopardy attaches, and then, boom, once it's jeopardy attaches, trial commences, I'll file my motion. And that would be, in my view anyway, not necessarily the criminal defense bar's view, is that jeopardy, that would be unfair, because just as the state has to provide notice and due process, defense should also give the state an opportunity to cure its defect. On appeal, I believe that if the shouldn't apply, it should not apply, because we've raised the issue. And I'm not quite sure whether double jeopardy will attach if Mr. Van Blijenburg prevails, because we haven't gotten that far. We're just addressing the issue of whether the complaint, the information, a charging document was defective. But that would be my position, that if anything, it should apply only on if the defense raises it at this point as a double jeopardy issue. But as I stated, I have not thoroughly looked at that, but you asked me a question, that's what I think.
And you have not raised a sufficiency claim here, right?
No, we did not. But I do believe, as in the Baker case, the court can take a look at the circumstances surrounding. This was a jury verdict, a jury decision, jury finding. And as the court is fully aware, they came back relatively quick with this decision. But when you look at the evidence of the case, and again, I go back to, I don't want to say shifting burden, but we have to go back to the basic foundation of due process. The purpose of the notice requirement is to make certain that the accused knows what he or she needs to defend against. when you take a look at this particular case, the only evidence they had from the beginning was a vehicle on the surveillance by the bus. That's it. It was only after, a day later that Mr. Van Blijenburg realized that something may have been a little bit more worse than it is. Now, the prosecuting attorney in her closing argument seems to infer that Van Blijenburg knew he had caused the death of Mr. Kishida. That's not quite true. That's not what he said. That's not what the evidence he said. Remember now, he testified. He testified that I thought I hit something. I blacked out. I thought I hit something because I heard a noise. I didn't know what it was. I looked behind me. I looked around and then I left. He only said after his attorney, after 2 years, 2 years and 2 more years for trial, when his attorney conceded he killed Kishida. So when the state said that even Van Blijenburg knew he killed Kishida, that's not the factual circumstances surrounding how he became aware of Mr. Kishida's death. He became aware of Mr. Kishida's death because he found out about it. He never said he did it himself. He said he was involved in he heard a bang and he left. And that's the importance of being informed of the elements of the charge and the factual basis of the charge. Had he been informed of that, because the police already knew, they spoke to the witnesses, they spoke to his friends who were the owner of the vehicle. They already knew. So that certainly could have been placed on the indictment itself, on the charging document itself. And guess what? I think the strategy, the position of defense would have been different.
Mr. Guerrero, Justice Wilson has a question, and I had one. And if Justice Wilson.
Thank you, CJ. If you want to go first, that's fine with me. I've already asked the question.
Well, I wanted just to focus briefly on count two, Mr. Guerrero. Doesn't it seem like simple negligence is something that's within the common understanding of folks or of defendants, sort of like in Mita, animal nuisance? They seem somewhat analogous. At least that argument could be made. And then if Mata Wells does apply, again, didn't the charge track the statute, at least the main part of the statute? And what's your response to those two arguments?
We all think that negligence is it's an accident. I would concede that negligence, by its definition, I would like to think anyway that we know that it's an accident. But when you put in the word simple in front of it and four differing definitions in the statute, it's no longer it's not common knowledge, because it becomes a situation where the legislatures specifically said, you don't know what simple negligence is. It's here in the statute. This is how it is defined. And just as in State versus Jardine, where the definition of substantial bodily injury, and I would concede, when you think about substantial bodily injury, we think of, common sense wise, must be something a little bit more serious than normal. But Jardine tells us it's a generic term because it's a generic term, it has to be defined. Simple negligence is a generic term. It has to be defined. And besides that, Justice Nakayama told us in Jardine that in this kind of situation where one of the elements is generic in its definition, there should be a factual basis, which goes to support Justice McKenna's questions and concerns in the Baker case of Rule 7. So,
about Mata Wells, if Mata Wells applies here, can't this reasonably be construed to charge a crime?
By its definition of simple negligence, I don't think so. Because most common people think of negligence as an accident. So by the definition of simple, which is even lesser than negligence, it's an accident. So I don't think it's a crime. But that's why the notice requirement is very specific under Article 14. Provide the information. I got it right here, and I finally found it. Sorry, Chief Justice. State versus Mata. Footnote number 3. Adopting this liberal standard for post-trial challenges, we do not mean to condone or encourage the prosecutors in failing to take greater care, et cetera, et cetera. 15 minutes to an hour more taught. And I don't mean that the prosecuting attorney's office is not doing its job. It is doing its job. But the standard under the Constitution requires the accused, the citizens, to be given proper notice.
In Mata, the motion was filed in the trial court, I believe. It was 2 months after the guilty verdict. So doesn't that, at least in that case, suggest the rule should apply to a post-trial motion while the case is still in the trial court?
Well, I think the progression of cases, just as this case is similar to Mata in that sense. I think the court is well aware that I was not trial counsel, that when I came on board, we filed that motion. We filed the motion to dismiss for a defective charge immediately prior to sentencing. So the facts, the timeline is almost similar, but it is still our position that it should not apply. The liberal approach should not apply in this case because at least in Mata, they knew what the elements were. In our case, it only came upon, we only were notified 2 days before trial. That's it. Maybe with a simple negligence, it was provided earlier, but at least with count one, it was provided about 2 to 3 days prior to the trial. So I don't think it should apply in Mr.
Yeah, it was actually it was in the original jury instructions, I believe, in 2018. So 2 years prior to trial, correct?
Well,
for count two.
Yes, for count two. Okay. But for count one, it's very clear. And the importance of that is this, Chief Justice. Look at the closing arguments. The closing argument by the prosecuting attorney makes no reference to this element. And since this is a jury verdict as opposed to a judge making his or her findings, we will never know whether the jury, in fact, even addressed that particular element. Due process requires burden of proof to be established by the government. The government itself did not address that at all.
Mr. Guerrero, we're up to 30 minutes. I am going to give you a time for rebuttal when we get to that point. But Justice Wilson and Justice Nakayama had questions. So Justice Wilson, you've been waiting patiently. Did you?
Thank you, CJ. Mr. Guerrero, this is following up on your discussion about count two with respect to how to analyze the lack of definition for simple negligence in the indictment. So let me ask you about a distinction that seems to be discussed in the Spratling case, a distinction that has to do with a technical, I think the way that the court defined it in Spratling was to suggest that it was a minor or technical deficiency to leave out the definition of injury being bodily injury. And therefore, that failure in the indictment to include the word bodily in describing injury was not a failure to include an element of the offense. It was more of a what was defined as a minor or technical deficiency. And with that in mind, the court looked beyond just the indictment to see whether there was sufficient notice. Now, in this case, I'm interested in your thoughts about whether we're going to characterize the lack of definition of simple negligence as a minor deficiency, or whether you think of it as an element of the offense. You have sort of described the significance, you think, of including the definition, but what I'm alluding to is whether, because this would be like in Spratling, perhaps a minor technical deficiency, would that allow for our review to include a analysis of the record, in which case, you know, the arguments and the instructions would, you know, suggest that the definition was included, because eventually that definition, the full definition, was included in the jury instructions, a full definition of simple negligence. So you see my question? My question is, do you think that in this case, because this was something that would be termed a technical deficiency, that in looking at the notice, the degree to which there was notice, we can look at the record in a way that would not be available if this was deemed to be an essential element of the offense?
Well, in this Spratling case, it was an assault in a third degree case. And the term that was missing from the charge was, as you stated, was bodily. And but the word injury was there. And as we know, in assault third cases, which is the lowest form of assault, aside from mutual affray, any injury constitute an assault in the third degree. Now, I believe it was the Hitchcock case. So it wouldn't apply in our case because it's the element of injury was already stated in the charge. So let me give you an example. If it's a theft case, if the state, for whatever reason, forgets to put in the amount that was allegedly taken, which increases the degree of the charge, it goes down to the lesser charge. In the Hitchcock case, for example, the charging document, you know, camping in a park, they didn't use the word park, but they used the word area. And that was sufficient because that's the lowest possible charge. I mean, they were interchangeable. In this case, using the Spratling case, simple negligence is totally different from assault in the third degree, because bodily injury, again, that's the lowest form of injury. So the defendant is provided notice that he injured someone. In this case, there's differing definitions. So his defense, Mr. Van Blyingsberg's defense, was, from you looking at it, he just blacked out. And I think the defense attorney stated that he blacked out, similar to that of a vehicle having a mechanical failure, not knowing it's going to happen, and an accident occurred. There was testimony that he may have been perhaps under the influence of some sort of prescribed drugs or even alcohol, but that turned out to be negative. He made it very clear. I was not under the influence of anything. I was not sleepy. I didn't put...
Well, let me interrupt you just for a moment. You're outlining a series of facts, and I'm wondering what that's relevant to. Are you saying that this series of facts suggests that the defense that would have been offered by Mr. Van Blyingsberg would have been a different one if he had had the full definition of simple negligence?
Well, we do know this. He testified based on the information that was provided. He took the stand and provided testimony. And as a matter of fact, his defense counsel, in his opening statement, essentially conceded, yes, he hit something. He ran. He didn't come back.
You're back to talking about the facts. If you can help me, how does that relate to the concept of simple negligence?
Well, if he passed out, he passed out. And that's why the government had all of that information, and they should have stated it in the complaint, in the charging document.
But how does that relate to the failure to provide a definition for simple negligence? Are you saying that somehow the failure to provide the definition of simple negligence meant that he was not aware of the defense that he should assert?
Well, not necessarily the defense, but he was not aware of the element, the specific element of the offense, so that he could prepare an adequate defense.
Mr. Guerrero, we're quite a bit over. Is there anything? I think at this point, perhaps we should turn to Mr. Fudo.
Okay. You know what, Chief Justice? I didn't see the light to say I got 10 minutes left.
Oh, I'm sorry. We'll try to make it a little brighter. I think we're actually at this point, we're pretty far over, and I think you've been able to make your points very well. We'll hear from Mr. Fudo. As I said, I will give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you so much,
Chief Justice. Mr. Fudo, please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Associate Justices. This court has said in Mata, our adoption of this liberal standard should also put an end to what appears to be a pattern and practice on the part of the criminal defense bar of waiting till after conviction before raising any objections to indictments. In this particular case, the verdict came down on March 9th, 2020. Baker, issued by this court, came down on March 13th, 2020, and counsel ultimately filed the motion to dismiss on October 20th, 2020. It would seem that the pattern and practice identified in Mata continued, at least in this case. I welcome the court's questions.
Justice McKenna. Oh, you're muted still, Justice McKenna. Sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Fudo, how would you distinguish Baker from this case? Because wasn't Baker also a post-conviction challenge to the sufficiency of the charge?
There was that challenge, yes, Your Honor. And distinguishing it by simply stating that, I didn't see in Baker any analysis of the constitutional issue with respect to notice. I didn't see any discussion of information that was supplied to defendant or known by defendant up until the point the motion was raised. In this case, following Mata Wells, and as the other Mata Wells cases say, you look at the information up until the point the motion is made. Furthermore, kind of touching on a question that you had for opposing counsel, in Mata, my recollection was the court, you probably hear me shuffling through papers, specifically said it applies, and I'll quote it, our adoption of this liberal construction standard is limited to construing indictments when the issue is only raised, there was an emphasis, after trial. This case, for me, is a simple application of Mata. This case also, for me, is a simple application of constitutional principles, which were not offended in this case because the record amply shows that before trial, with respect to the two contested omissions, defendant knew. Moreover, it's not a case where we need to speculate as to whether the jury considered it, because the instructions were correct and included it. The importance of that is the conviction was not based on a defective charge. The conviction was based on the evidence and the proper construction of the law as set forth in the jury instructions.
Great, thank you. I thought Justice Edens was next, and then Justice Wilson. Justice Edens?
You know, Mr. Food, I see this as basically a hit and run crime. You know, it's designed to get drivers to remain, return to the scene, provide the 291 C14 information. It's not really where you park your vehicle. You know, your theory of the case was there was no stop at all, right?
Correct.
Now, I'm wondering if
let me qualify that, Justice. Correct to the extent that's what defendant said and the evidence showed.
Okay, so what I'm wondering is this, is are there two ways to prove a 291 C12 crime? One, no stop and no remain, no return, sort of the scenario in this case. Or two, sort of the Baker scenario. Stop and return to the scene, and somehow maybe the person falls short of the statute. So I guess what I'm wondering is, does the unnecessary obstruction of traffic clause really only come into play in number two when the state's pursuing a conviction based on, you know, post-accident deficiency, that type of theory? In other words, does it even apply that Baker attendant circumstance element to the first no stop, no remain, no return situation as this case?
With all due respect to the court in Baker, I say no.
Now, let me ask you this. Can the Van Blyenburg indictment be construed to allege all the elements of the number one situation that I referred to, no stop, no return, no remain?
Without qualification, yes.
And if one charging alternative in an indictment is sufficient as far as the elements being proved, but another alternative was defective, does that invalidate a conviction based on the sufficiently proved charge?
No, because the constitutional underpinnings for this case and this matter is notice. Defendant had notice. Defendant suffered absolutely no prejudice. He admitted, and if you just give me a moment and bear with some of the, what I will call coarse language. Okay, defendant said he did not want to be anywhere near where he'd been in the accident, worried about something like witnesses, tried to get involved, tried to avoid getting in trouble. He did not call the police. He was afraid about trouble. He left that area intentionally and never returned because he didn't want to see what happens. The coarse language. He also admitted he was the driver of the car that hit and killed the victim. He failed to immediately stop at the scene or close there to as possible because he failed to return and remain at the accident, even though there was an opportunity for him to do so and a place he could park. Failed to give any information to police officer any about any involvement in the accident before he was arrested. I just don't see any infringement of the right to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation. And in kind of like a question that you were asking before, without getting too deep in the woods, I'm not even certain that Baker's analysis, please, with all due respect, was a liberal construction as opposed to a very technical, hyper-technical, literal interpretation, which I think
could, I'm sorry to interject there, Mr. Fudo, could Baker be just construed narrowly to a close proximity 291 C12 charge and not apply in this situation?
Okay, naturally, I agree to the last point. As to the first point, here's my fundamental concern. As the court has recently and repeatedly said in opinions authored by Justice Nakayama, Justice McKenna, and Justice Wilson, this court is bound to construe statutes so as to avoid absurd results. Furthermore, a rational, sensible interpretation, a practical interpretation of a statute is preferred to one which is unreasonable, impractical, inconsistent, contradictory, or illogical. In my opinion, for whatever it may be worth, the sheer possibility that the stop would be, the individual would think he must stop, notwithstanding the fact that it obstructs traffic, I don't believe that's fair to a liberal interpretation of the charge. I'm not debating at all whether or not that last sentence qualifies an attendant circumstance, but the Model Wells rule seems to say you liberally construe the charge. And in Mata, they cited a case, United States versus Kaneshiro, the information wasn't there, but they were satisfied because the statute was identified, which is the case here.
Very well. Justice Wilson, your question.
Thank you. Mr. Fudo, I'm following you that this defense didn't have anything to do with the idea of possibly having to leave the scene because of obstruction of traffic, right? Defense didn't have anything to do with it.
Correct, Your Honor.
The proposition that where the defense really doesn't address one of the elements of the offense, proposition that if the defense doesn't address one of the elements of the defense, then it doesn't really matter if the government proves that defense, or that, excuse me, proves that element, obviously is inconsistent with the proposition that the government has to give notice of the charge, even if it looks like one of the elements is going to be conceded by the defendant. And that brings me to the interesting situation with respect to the way that the case was analyzed in Baker and Shaw, where, you know, the issue of a defective indictment was raised for the first time on appeal. So you could say that the, you know, the liberal Model Wells standard was being applied, but the court didn't look beyond the indictment, and the court didn't necessarily do an analysis based on whether there was evidence that would support an element. In that case, I think the analysis was just whether or not there was an element of the charge left out, and then that was considered to be a basis upon which to find there wasn't adequate notice because it just was an element left out. So I guess my question is it your view that Baker and Shaw need to be overruled because in that case, the court just determined that because there was an element missing, there wasn't adequate notice and therefore the indictment was defective?
I don't want to put that onus on this court, and I don't want to offer an opinion about what was or was not briefed. But what I will say is it's not a structural error. Under this court's analysis of what is a structural error, this defective indictment, alleged defect in it in the indictment, is not structural.
It's you're right. I mean, structural error, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the structural error isn't addressed in this area of jurisprudence. It's just the question about whether there was adequate notice. And the remedy, I guess, is to retry, send it back, and put together an indictment that provides adequate notice, right? But you're implying in a way that I think that structural notice is a way of saying that there should or should not be a somewhat automatic determination that an indictment is defective once there is an element lacking, as opposed to in the Spratling case where there was discussion about the defect in the indictment not being the lack of an element, but more of a technical defect.
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is, in what you offered, in the scenario you offered, it assumes that there was no notice. If there was indeed no notice, well, then the constitutional right article says, Article 1 and 6 and 14 say, okay, then the conviction cannot stand. Here, there was notice, but more significantly, it's not a structural defect. What I said was the court, under its own analysis, this wouldn't constitute a structural error that rendered the trial fundamentally unfair or unreliable to ascertain the truth. The U.S. Supreme Court recently in U.S. versus Gear made that proposition abundantly clear with respect to the R-E-I-H-A-F, I think it's spelled error, where in felon in possession cases prior to that case, there was no mens rea. So what did the court say in Greer? Not structural error. The both individuals, there was two individuals, companion cases, Greer and Gray, they had notice. Convictions affirmed. Here, the defendant, it's regrettable what happened, but he was not convicted because he did not know or his counsel did not know. And as Justice Eden said, hit and run, that's exactly how his counsel characterized this in his opening statement, which to me clearly shows you hit someone and run, probably is a figurative expression for did not stop. No prejudice. Should be affirmed. Brendan Kishida died. And I don't say that to tug at the heartstrings, but out of respect for the nature of the case and any inquiry that has to do with prejudice.
But I don't understand the degree of injury or the fact that the defendant died in this case should be a reason why we should apply the Wells Modest standard, or a reason why we should not require the government to prove the issue that we're talking about that has to do with proving that there was not an obstruction to the traffic. I mean, how does the fact that there was a death in this case mean that we have to apply a certain legal standard?
That's not what I said. The reason I mentioned the individual by name, out of respect.
All right, thank you, Mr. Fudo. We'll turn now to Justice McKenna.
Thank you. Mr. Fudo, the Baker case did acknowledge, at least, and in the Baker case, the state did argue the Model Wells liberal construction standard. But it appears in Baker, this court was very clear that elements must be alleged. And it appears that the cases in which the liberal construction standard have been applied is when perhaps the way the charge was phrased was not as detailed as it should be. However, the elements were at least somewhat stated, as in the bodily injury versus injury situation. But with respect to the element of not coming to a stop, which we held in Baker was an attendant circumstance, it appears that there's an argument being raised here that it can and cannot apply. And it appears that if it is an attendant circumstance and it is an element, whether or not it is easily proven or not, or conceded or not, it is an element that needs to be charged. And in this case, if it had been charged, the state would have had the opportunity to perhaps present evidence through the witness who responded to the scene as to the traffic conditions. In addition, perhaps the defendant, when he testified as to what he saw in his, the rearview mirror after he came to, according to his testimony, might have also presented evidence. And maybe it was a heavy traffic time. We don't know. We just don't know in this case. And so it appears that, are you suggesting that Baker does not stand for the proposition that the additional attendant circumstances is not an element that needs to be charged?
No.
Are you saying that we should distinguish, we should limit Baker at this time?
No, I'm not saying that, but using or paraphrasing what you said, when you regarding the other cases that somewhat defined the element, I think using your phrasing and consistent with the Baker holding, the charge was somewhat defined. To make it, or what I think should be clarified, if anything, would be that it's not a freestanding attendant circumstance. The core of the attendant circumstance is the stop and how it is to be made. So the charge made clear that the defendant failed to stop, and whether it was as close to there as possible or otherwise, he knew of this requirement before trial. He had the jury instructions. Rather than challenging the indictment.
How can, if the purpose of a charge is to provide notice to prepare a defense, how can jury instructions cure the lack of notice when the evidence has already been completed?
He had the jury instructions before the trial. They were the same instructions during the trial, Your Honor. And with respects to defects in charge, it's waivable. As this court said in In Re Doe, State versus Hernandez, if a guilty plea, a proper guilty plea, precludes a defendant from later asserting any non-jurisdictional claims, including constitutional challenges to the pretrial proceedings. What this court has made clear, I believe it's in Schwartz, this charging language dilemma is not jurisdictional. We live through the Wheeler circumstance to have Schwartz clarify it's not jurisdictional, and it's not structural, and the constitutional requirement for notice was fulfilled. I don't see it as a technical error. What I see it is as a more a technical motion that just completely disregards Motta Wells and just throw it to the court and then let's be done with it. Baker, because it didn't discuss the actual quantum of evidence presented to the defendant at the time the motion was made, I don't think the proposition can go much farther in addressing that point, because it wasn't an issue in the opinion.
I have another question, and that is, I think you, with respect to the simple negligence charge, it actually referred to the definition of simple negligence by number, by the number of the statute as defined in whatever the statute was. And, but this court clearly said in Wheeler that including a citation to the statute in the charge does not cure a charge that omits an essential element. And how would you address that language in Wheeler with respect to just citing to the number of the statute in count two?
I don't disagree that merely citing a statute would give adequate notice to cure a defective charge. But the issue here is not curing a defective charge. The issue here is whether the defendant had proper notice such that he could prepare his defense and later have sufficient information to invoke a double jeopardy type challenge. So I'm not in any sense trying to discuss, argue whether a defective charge can be cured, because that's not the issue. The issue, as this court has made very clear with Mata, is the notice, the constitutional requirement for notice of the nature and cause of the accusation. He had it. With respect to simple negligence, as Justice Rechtenwald noted, he had it from 2018. As Mata noticed, if that was defective, why wait 2 years to bring the motion?
Have we in any case said that a proposed jury instructions from the state cure the notice requirement?
I wouldn't say cure it, but what you have made, to, in my humble opinion, quite clear, is that the defective jury instruction, A, is not structural error, and B, it's analyzed on the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I think maybe that was Nicholas or Nichols. It was Justice Nakayama's decision.
This is not an issue of a defective jury instruction, but is there any other court that has held that proposed jury instructions can substitute for a defective charge?
No, I think the analysis went to whether the individual defendant, whether the state could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the omission of an element in a jury instruction was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So clearly, the omission of an element in the jury instruction subject to harmless error beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, the instructions had the element. So there's no reason to even go to the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in that sense. But reverting back to Mata,
could you cite to me the cases that stand for the proposition that omission of an element is subject to the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard?
Oh, off the top of my, okay, well, let me see. Messed up. 20. Structural. Okay. Other than I believe it was Nichols, which we more or less rely on. Oh, here's one. Aplaca. Failure to submit the question of Katina's age and Aplaca's knowledge of her age to the jury analyzed for harmless error. It occurred in the trial process, and that harmless error standard applies to errors implicating constitutional rights. The essential sentencing factor constitutionally required to be found by the jury was not submitted. However, the failure to so instruct was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In a plaque of this court was citing Netter, N-E-D-E-R versus U.S. 527 U.S. 1, omission of entire element from jury determination subject to harmless error.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Fudo, Justice Nakayama has a question, but just to follow up quickly, you're arguing by analogy to the jury instruction cases that a harmless error analysis should apply in the charging context as well?
My argument subsumes that, but I think my central point is it's just not a structural error. So when it's not a structural error, even though it affects a constitutional right, you look to see whether the defendant was prejudiced. Now, the quantum of proof to sustain that burden, I don't disagree with harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Justice, thank you. Justice Nakayama.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Mr. Fudo, further to comments made by Justice Edens, when you read 291C-12, one of the requirements is, and I think you mentioned, any person shall immediately stop the vehicle at the scene of the collision. Then the last sentence says, every stop shall be made without obstructing traffic. So doesn't the last sentence presume that there was a stop? So if there wasn't a stop, would the last sentence come into play at all?
You know, I don't think so. But my argument doesn't turn on that. But there's one thing that I think that was, you didn't actually state and was, I don't think there was much more than a gloss by the court in Baker. It was, or as close thereto as possible.
The facts of Baker were really different from this case, though.
Quite different.
Yeah. So, and there was a concern about whether there was a stop and whether or not the next stop was as close thereto as possible.
Agreed. But I think it's very important in the court's interpretation in Baker, and again, I don't want to offend the court, but I don't know if it gave the appropriate consideration under the rational, sensible, practical interpretation that's preferred of as possible. I don't believe saying that because it's possible, the person could return and stop in an area, but obstruct, it just doesn't, to me, make sense. I don't know people that would return, stop, and knowingly obstruct traffic. I think that as possible, it means
weren't they kind of obstructing traffic? I thought they were obstructing traffic in Baker because it was on Kamehameha Highway.
And I'll defer to your memory. You were one of the justices on the opinion, but I'm just saying that the as possible, I don't know that the Baker interpretation, I don't know that it accords the proper liberal construction to as possible.
Well, that was more concerned without, I thought it was more about shall be made without obstructing traffic more than necessary.
Yes, it definitely, that was it. But the interpretation that Justice Pollack, I'm saying Justice Pollack only because he authored the opinion about what the as possible meant,
It
seems like he struggled to find this scenario that wasn't reasonable. It wasn't practical. It seemed to be illogical. And it's supposed to be a liberal construction, not sift through the terminology or the text of the statute and find this one outlier interpretation where, yeah, that could happen. I don't know if that's really a liberal construction, but I'm not here to re-argue Baker. You said what you said. Excuse me. The court said what it said, but I don't know that Baker, the resolution therein, drives the analysis in this case. With or without Baker, bottom line, notice.
Okay.
Was there a notice to satisfy the constitutional requirement? I would have to say yes.
Thank you.
Very well. Mr. Fudo, anything else for the court today?
No, not specific. Oh, well, one point. If it comes to be against my best wishes or best hopes that this court finds structural error in this type of omission, to me, that would be proposing a new rule that should be purely prospective. I thank the court for your time, your indulgence, and
thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mr. Fudo. Mr. Guerrero, a brief rebuttal.
Yes, Chief Justice, I'll just take a minute. From what I've just heard, and I don't mean to say this lightly, but it appears that what I heard is the ends justified the means. And that's not what due process is all about. Article 1, Section 14 requires notice. It's there. Notice of the elements of the offense, the charge.
Mr. Guerrero, Justice Eddings has a question.
I'm sorry, go ahead, Justice Eddings, I'm sorry.
Mr. Guerrero, let's say a teen driver hits a pedestrian. That teen driver is shaken up, but wants to help. And that teen driver gets out of the car and helps immediately, stopping the car in the middle of the street. Traffic is just backing up. The person then complies with 291C14, you know, but refuses to get back in that car, is just, you know, sort of traumatized, doesn't want to move that car, and therefore obstructs traffic more than necessary. Has that teen violated 291C12 because the stop was made without obstructing traffic more than necessary?
Well, if you read the statute, 291C12 or 13, they're similar in that. 702.205 tells us that the elements of the offenses are attendant circumstances, one of them. And Baker already made it very clear that the statute is clear. It is an element of the offense. So the person, I guess it would depend on the circumstances. If it's clearly obstructing traffic, then he should move. He or she should move. With guidance, I'm at that point in time, and we're looking ahead, I'm just speculating on the scenario, he should move ahead. And then it would be up to the state to decide whether they're going to be charging that, utilizing their discretion. But the statute 702.205 and Baker makes it clear. The elements of the offense is embodied in the statute. If it's embodied in the statute, that's an element. And notice must be provided. And that is the point I was trying to get to when I heard Mr. Fudo. And when I listened to that, the thing that I immediately think about is the ends justified the means. And that's not what it's all about. Due process is you have to provide notice. It's there. It's MARA, as far back as MARA, another 10, 15 minutes. It's not enough to say that you knew about it. We gave it to you before you testified or after you testified.
Mr. Guerrero, Justice McKenna has a question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Go ahead, Chief Justice McKenna. I'm sorry.
Mr. Guerrero, do you agree that a failure to include elements in our charge should be viewed, is actually now being viewed under a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard? Do you think that that is the standard that we have been applying based on the MARA rules?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so.
Okay. Well, is it your position that if we had a case in which someone strikes someone and there's a lot of witnesses, the car races off, never stops, there's no dispute that the car never stops anywhere and is later arrested because the element of not pulling over without blocking traffic to the degree possible, because that wasn't charged, that wasn't in the indictment, that a conviction should also be set aside in a case like that?
Well, I'm not quite sure how that's in this particular case with Mr. Van Blyenburg. He did actually stop at the residence.
Right. So that was my follow-up question. In your case, it's my understanding that your argument is that his testimony was that his friend's place was less than a minute away. So he went and stopped there. Now that's viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to your client. But he did stop somewhere close by. And He also did testify that he looked in the rear view mirror. But it's my understanding that your theory is that if it had been properly charged, he might have been able to present additional evidence regarding the defense of not stopping at, you know, as he should have.
Yes, he would have been able to properly and adequately prepare a defense. But to answer your other question,
but how is the state supposed to prove that in a case where there are no eyewitnesses?
Well, it's circumstantial. It can be direct or circumstantial. Direct in the sense that there was a video of the vehicle by the bus. Circumstantial in the sense that they spoke with friends of Mr. Van Blyenburg.
So the police officer could say that there was no construction, there were no traffic stops going on at that time, normally around that time of day, the traffic on a road is sparse, or, you know, it doesn't happen that much. So you're saying that the element can be proven by circumstantial evidence.
Yes, but the issue again in this case and in your scenario is the notice, is the due process notice requirements, and substantial bodily injury in assault second with a baseball bat. Notice requirement. It's the Constitution that we have. And going back to my initial statements in the beginning. If it's embodied in the Constitution, if it's there, written, drafted, we know what it is. We don't have to think. It's there.
Well, Mr. Fudo has cited jury instruction standards, which have been viewed sometimes under a harmless standard. But is there anything in the Constitution, Hawaii Constitution, that requires proper jury instructions?
No. What's required in the Constitution is to be informed of the charge. You have a right to remain silent, not to self-incriminate yourself. You have a specific right to unreasonable searches and seizures, and that there's consequences that goes with that. In terms of the trial procedures, Rule 7 tells us, Penal Rule 7 tells us, give us the specific facts. And the reason for that, it all goes to the notice requirement. And again, I think I'm saying it now for a third time, but we cannot have simply because the ends justifies the mean. That is not the Constitution that we have.
Haven't convictions been set aside because the element of whether a offense occurred in the city and county of Honolulu was not alleged?
I'm sorry, Yaron, what case was that? I'm sorry.
Oh, are you not aware of cases in which convictions have been set aside because the element of whether the proper venue, whether it occurred within the city and county of Honolulu was not alleged, even though there was no dispute whatsoever as to whether or not an offense occurred in the city and county of Honolulu?
Yes, Your Honor. This I don't have the specific case, but in Honolulu, there's various venues in district court. And where sometimes the dividing line is a little bit off from what makes ever Honolulu. And I believe that there was a case where the incident occurred in Honolulu, but the charge was in ever, and that was subsequently vacated. And I think there was also, I'm not sure if it was held up on appeal or it even went to appeal, but that venue is a requirement. And if it's not proven, then it's haven't proven the case. And in this particular case, unfortunately, the charging document was inadequate. And I think when the charging document becomes inadequate to that point, what the situation that we have is the situation that we have here now. There's accusations now. There's saying that
Mr. Guerrero, if you could sort of wrap up at this point.
Okay.
Any further final thoughts for the court at this point?
Your Honor, he was not provided proper notice. Baker, Jardine, going back to Gendrush, that cannot be overlooked, that cannot be oversighted. It's fundamental. And I would ask the court to grant the writ and to reverse or vacate the conviction in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Guerrero. Thank you, Mr. Fudo. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Ua ho'oku'u ia mai ne, kea aha ho'okolokolo ki e ki hanohano o ka aku moku aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.